host of the Voice of Florida Architecture, the podcast for AIA Florida, elevating architects who exemplify architectural excellence. The AIA College of Fellows, founded in 1952, seeks to stimulate a sharing of interest among fellows, promote the purposes of AIA, advance the profession of architecture, mentor young architects, and be of ever-increasing service to society. Today, we have the distinct honor of speaking with the 2025 AIA College of Fellows Bursar, Mr. William J. Hercules, FAIA. Congratulations and welcome to the podcast.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. It's great to be here.
So what makes this a prouder moment for us is that you hail from AIA Florida by the way of AIA Orlando. So we consider you one of our own. So you make us very proud.
Thank you. It's great to be part of this.
So I find the stories of how someone decided to study and practice architecture very intriguing. Please share your story. Did you know that at a young age you wanted to be an architect?
Well, I think I'm one of the freaks that sort of did. Like many pre-architecture kids, I had my share of Erecto Tinko Lego toys, you know, trying to build tall buildings, you know, as many pieces that I could allow. I also liked to draw, but I really didn't connect the two of those together until I was maybe in junior high school when I was introduced to mechanical drafting. And, oh, you could actually plan out what you build? My high school had an architectural drafting class that was taught by a real life architect. Looking back on it, I think he was retired military and he just wanted something else to do. But it was a great stepping stone into confirming what I really wanted to do long term. I was also the oldest grandson of my maternal grandfather, who was a draftsman for a design build company that did branch banks. And I came to know later that he had pretty good technical knowledge, beautiful lettering, and great graphical communication ability. He also taught me about baseball and bowling and other kinds of sports. I was about 10 years old when he retired, so I really didn't appreciate what he did until I was into my formal education. And then he passed away when I was in my early 20s. So I didn't really have the opportunity to connect all those dots and really dig into my career with him. He did encourage me with his library. In fact, I have a 1941 AIA architectural graphic standards with all kinds of cellophane tape and all other things that are put together. And I have his drafting tools as sort of relics. He used to draft on sheets of linen, that sort of thing back in the day. So early on, I thought that my career would be rather technical, you know, how to keep water out of the buildings. I didn't have friends who were architects that I could shadow. And in those days, that was sort of unheard of. The old photos of architects' desks lined up in a row, that really was a thing. And in some regards, they were production workers. And if we fast forward today, most of the young architects feel the same way. So although the tools change, the pressure to produce really stays the same. So I digress a little bit, but I didn't have the resources to attend a university, nor did I have anyone around me to counsel my early professional career path. So my high school guidance counselor said, well, here's some materials about architecture schools. And that was about it. So I enrolled in a community college because that's all I could afford, but I could pay cash for it. And I earned my AA in architectural technology. While I was there, I learned about paths towards licensure, minimum education requirements, et cetera. So I was really driven that I wanted to be a licensed architect as fast as I could, thinking that was the path towards self-actualization. But that was kind of a mirage. Immediately afterward, I became employed in a firm and also enrolled in a university's night program with the help of the local AIA chapter scholarship program. And the rest I just put on my credit card because I didn't know any better. And no one was helping through financial matters, you know, thinking that I had a cost and a credit line. I figured it out. So, of course, that wasn't the best way to launch my professional career. But I did wind up with a baccalaureate degree, and I was licensable after a few years of apprenticeship.
It would be interesting, and I don't know if you've taken the time to do it, to see how the graphic standards has changed between now and the you said the 1941 version. That'd be interesting to see. You've been a member of AIA for 32 years, and you've served AIA Florida in many capacities. You've chaired the Florida Foundation for Architecture, and in 2024, we're awarded the Anthony Tony Pallara Individual AIA Service Award. Now, this award recognizes outstanding service to AIA Florida, which is over and above that normally required of a member of AIA. You were elevated to fellowship in 2015, which we'll cover in detail shortly. But if you will, first, will you please share with our listeners about your service representing AIA Florida on the National Strategic Council?
Well, most architects don't know what the Strategic Council is. So let me take a slight detour. The AIA's National Strategic Council was a product of a major reorganization of the AIA governance structure back in the early 20-teens. Our friend Mickey Jacob, FAIA, was a national president during that time. And the governing body of the AIA was significantly reduced from a state and regional representational board of 60-ish plus people to about 10 or so. And the big thinking where the profession should head and how the AIA might influence what was to be done was by a newly created body, the Strategic Council, sort of a larger representative think tank in a way that produces content for the board to consider as it governs. So over its 10-year history, I think it was officially convened in 2015. The purpose and means have morphed somewhat and was considered during the Members' Voice Task Force, which I actively contributed to. I was on that team also. And it was under review again, or is now, with the newly formed Governance Task Force led again by our friend Mickey Jacob. He seems to kind of keep turning up. The council selects about a half dozen topics every year to study and has regular progress reports to each other and to the board, as well as final reports at the end of the year for the board to consider as it develops its various agendas for the coming year. And I found most of the members of the council are very passionate game changers who are willing to dig into their team's research projects and expect that their work does meaningfully contribute to the AIA's larger professional discourse. I was elected by AIA Florida in August of 2020 to begin service the following year in 2021 for a 3-year term. During my time on the council, we studied a wide variety of topics. My first year was, how does the AIA support architects in rural America? Which, frankly, I'd never thought about. But in reality, even in Florida, we do have architects that are practicing in rural parts of the state. What about the value of architecture to clients? That was the subject of my second year. That was a project we ended up teaming with the Construction Owners Association of America and have made some very interesting friends. In fact, just earlier today, I was on a Zoom call with the executive director who actually lives in Florida, in Pensacola. COA is a professional organization of about 3,000 members that represent institutional owners that develop literally hundreds of projects annually. And they were thrilled that the AIA was even asking them about this question. So they, in fact, invited us to do a listening tour at their annual conference in Denver. So, my last year on the council, we addressed how architecture supports well-being. And this was a project that led to the 2024 Architecture and Well-being Policy Resolution that was passed in the General Assembly of the National Business Meeting by an overwhelming supermajority. And while my term officially ended in 2023, the 2024 council leaders asked me to help guide the substance of that work forward. I also have to add that during my time on the council, I've developed some quick and long lifetime friendships with people that I've worked with on that council. So all in all, that really strengthens the bonds of community, which is the AIA.
So you co-chaired the AIA slash AGC Joint Committee. Please share the purpose of this committee with us.
Well, because of my work on the council on the value of architecture during my second year, and especially with the Construction Owners Association of America, another colleague of mine on that team and I were invited to join the AIA AGC Joint Committee. Now, the Joint Committee has been around for more than 75 years. And for about 70 of those years, it's been a forum for architects and contractors just to hash out their grievances with, sort of like a bad marriage counseling without a counselor, or kind of like union negotiations without a mediator. Over the last few years, though, I think both sides have realized that collaborating has some significant mutual benefits. So the choice to collaborate, though it's voluntary, unless they're bound contractually by an IPD agreement or something like that. So we thought we would develop a guide for both sides to understand each other's pressures and perspectives to establish better collaboration despite the project type or contractual delivery method. We're kind of in the middle of that process right now, and we hope to have the content ready for both boards to ratify late 2025 as a joint product, which is kind of a big deal. We stopped short of calling it a best practice because best practice is kind of a weird indeterminate term, but we will not likely publish a white paper based on the input of some of the younger members on our team. We don't read white papers, is what they're saying. We listen to podcasts. We do all these other things. So posters on social media, podcasts, that sort of thing. The idea is not to just set it and forget it, but it's to really adjust the way that we interact as the two sort of meta organizations.
You know, this sounds like it would be a really good session to introduce this idea and the collaboration and your findings at the convention.
Well, I don't disagree. I don't know that we're going to be quite ready yet. Later this month, we've got another meeting where we're looking at all the pieces and trying to put it together. And, we're architects and builders. We're not editors either. So
That's true. So, like you mentioned, in 2024, you successfully submitted and steered the resolution for AIA health and well-being policy, which is palpable considering your career promoting health and well-being through architecture. Share how you found the WJL's health and then explain the breadth of the impact the resolution will have on architects and society as a whole.
well, both of those are very divergent questions. So let's start with the first one. Most of my career has been in the design of places for healthcare, hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, clinics, long-term care facilities. I've had the opportunity to work with some great people in various firms and even clients who have mentored me with their varied experiences. This is a team sport. It absolutely is. Toward the end of the Great Recession, some colleagues and clients encouraged me to launch a practice that served to like a bridge between their business ideas and the typical architectural services, sort of creating straw men, let's think about this differently. Well, what if we did this? What if we did this? But we're not really drawing things directly, but I had to draw on my architectural experiences to serve them. Effectively, I help senior executives of healthcare systems really shape their future places of care, is what I do. It's my day job. And this is more than just master planning a campus, although it many times includes that. It also includes connecting with market analysis and other business analytics to inform what might be and ultimately what should be built to serve a community's healthcare needs. Additionally, the healthcare design space has a subculture that is somewhat aligned with the practice of medicine. And as such, some architects have used research related to design effects to inform their design proposals. This kind of research is decidedly not, well, we did this on our last dozen projects and nobody died. No, this is mostly peer-reviewed, meaning it has solid methodological development, robust data sets, statistically relevant and repeatable results. And most architects, while they're well-intentioned, simply are not wired to operate like that. So, for example, every architectural firm has somebody that really loves writing specifications and coordinating door hardware groups. But in reality, most don't get into architecture to only do that. In the same way, there are some that are wired to dig into the research and are very happy that it exists. And they're very happy for others to interpret it for them. Nonetheless, there's a significant amount of research that already does exist that can inform better design related to occupant health and well-being. However, that research is almost never cited, or if it's referenced, the references are thinly veiled smoke screens to add credibility to an architect's design proposal as opposed to digging into the meat of the matter. The initial point of the Resolution 24-1 was to say that this is an ethical issue. If architects have access to information that can help their clients improve occupant well-being or the opposite, avoid harm, then they have an obligation to society and their clients to bring it forward for consideration. So let's say that a physician performs an annual physical exam, and part of that is routine blood screening. There are certain markers in human blood that indicate the presence of certain disease, such as diabetes or even cancer. So if your physician chooses not to tell you that you have cancer, are you okay with that? Well, of course not. Even a mediocre malpractice attorney would prevail. So we have access to this information. We have a direct obligation to notify our clients for their benefit and the benefit of their future occupants. So over the last 5 years, a collection of weekend warriors in architecture, medicine, and bioethics have been researching, publishing, and presenting with a central thesis. Architecture is a component of care along with other human interventions like medicinal or surgical therapies. And this evidence is that voluminous and that impactful. For example, the Center for Health Design, an organization that collects this information and is attached to the AIA's healthcare design community, the Academy of Architecture for Health, has close to 6,500 articles in that knowledge repository, which sounds like a lot. But if you compare that to the 37 million articles that are in the National Institutes of Health under PubMed or any of the other repositories, it pales in comparison by a factor of 6,000 to one. Most of those in the NIH are related to systemic diseases or things in a cellular level, not really architecturally related. But the bigger idea is that there's this enormous trove of data around the effects of various types of interventions that does exist, and we have an obligation to use it.
What is your deliverable? Is it a report to a specific client on a specific building type, or is it overarching generalized themes of what you just talked about, that architecture is a component of patient
Well,
care?
that's a great question. The AIA's Framework for Design Excellence, which was also another target of the resolution, addresses well-being, but they address it in a fairly high level. Well, it's better if you have a view to nature, and they stop there, as opposed to citing the specific research that talks about the effects of natural views or how the sun tracks across the sky and how that affects your mood and overall well-being, et cetera. There was an interesting study that was published in 2022 that identified a significant 43% reduction in falls in a long-term care facility by changing the lighting types from cool white fluorescent tubes to programmable LEDs that mimicked the sun's path across the sky every day of the year. What does this mean? Well, further study is required, of course. But what it does suggest is that the quality of the light, and more importantly, the connection to things that are much bigger than the architecture, like the sun, do matter. So if you're going to design a long-term care facility, you would want to know this. So this group of weekend warriors, we've been playing in this space for the last few years. And we've begun now talking with various health systems. We're doing a project in Vancouver right now where we're looking at several long-term care facilities as they're being developed. We're identifying the goals that are identified in the clinical service plan and then using those as a path forward to identify various types of research that do exist and then challenging the design. We're not plain designers, but we're challenging the design team to think more deeply. What about this study? What about this study? What about this framework of thinking about things? It's a much higher level peer review than a like a technical code compliant peer review or a constructability peer review.
If an architect wanted to learn more about this and they're working on a project and wanted to see what was available, they would hire you to as a consultant.
They can also working directly for the health systems, because many of those, or even developers of long-term care campuses, because they will develop their own standards, and they will base their standards on, well, I think that we did this on another project 10 years ago. What do you think? Okay, that's fine. As opposed to, well, let's let the research really help us shape some of these approaches. And it's not just a component of parts. It's not, a patient room or a resident room or even a classroom for that matter, but it's the systems that are created by how these spaces are arranged. So it's much more complex than just a collection of parts.
Bill Hercules, FAIA, FACHA, and ACHE. Please explain the significance of the triple fellowship.
Well, I think all professional fellowships are earned either by subjective juries, architecture, for example, or by objective examination, medicine, for example. So elevation in any fellowship is an honor, to be sure, but it also recognizes a higher order of contribution and its correlate, a higher order of expectations. Some people are driven to reach higher, to go for the next gear. Many people do that in a variety of ways. I know a few Ironman triathletes, and I know some people have attempted to climb Mount Everest. I don't do that, and I think they're crazy, but I appreciate what they do in the process of personal discipline and preparation required to do it. So my fellowships are in general architecture, my healthcare architecture specialty, and my healthcare client space. I have fellowships from the American Institute of Architects, the American College of Healthcare Architects, and the American College of Healthcare Executives. The journey for my two architectural fellowships were not just a list of, hey, I just sat on this board or participated on this council. No, my sponsors asked me questions about myself that I really embarrassingly couldn't sufficiently answer. And that part of the process was both frustrating and illuminating. So, did my career up to that point really mean anything beyond my project work or my service? What were the ripples that were created? Were they significant enough to be elevated? Apparently, those juries thought so, but my experience during that process was quite humbling. My ACHE fellowship was a multi-hour exam on a wide range of topics related to healthcare administration. And I thought, well, since I've been observing this for decades, I know what's going on. I've got a really good idea what all of this meant. And boy, was I wrong. But I discovered that the depth of this domain early enough to prepare for it, acquire the academic resources, and pass the exam on my first try, it felt like I was doing AREs all over again. But the reason that I did it was to better understand my clients, their pressures, their opportunities, and the breadth of their domains, and how all of those fit within the larger healthcare context. So, to my knowledge, I'm the only one that has that set of fellowships globally. But eventually, someone else is going to join me, or frankly, it might even surpass me. And I hope somebody does. That will only improve our profession. So, here's a reality check. If I thought, if I explain these fellowships to the clerk at the grocery store, they're still going to just look at me and say, okay, well, it's still $250. So I think our context may be narrower than we actually.
As I mentioned earlier, you were elevated to the College of Fellows in 2015, and it's my understanding that less than 3% of AIA members hold the prestigious FAIA designation. AIA fellows are recognized for their exceptional work and contributions to architecture and society. So, what is the purpose of the College of Fellows, in your opinion, and why is it important that we honor its traditions?
College is one of the highest membership honors, and it recognizes architects for their, quote, exceptional work and contributions to architecture and society. Okay, so the official fivefold purpose of the College of Fellows is to stimulate a sharing among interests among fellows, promote the purposes of the AIA, advance the profession of architecture, mentor young architects, and be of ever-increasing society. And frankly, this group of people does that. The College of Fellows has an interesting history, and the first fellows were named in 1857, and that was during the Institute's founding, although the meaning of the title of fellow has developed in the intervening 168 years or so. When one is invested into the college, they're given a hardbound copy of the Red Book, which describes the history of the AIA and the College of Fellows, as well as containing various lists of various awards of the college and the fellows invested to date from 1857 on. So every year that book is updated, and it's become a living chronicle of the Institute and of the college. So on one hand, many architects both recognize and challenge these traditions of the clients to reflect their culture and their architecture. 18th century polymath Johann Wolfgang Goethe said that architecture is frozen music, meaning that it's of its time. On the other hand, the meanings of traditions must be protected to tell the complete story for future generations. So if one dives deeper into AI's history, one will see the wide variation of ideas that even to this day continue to shape its relevance to each other and to society. So one such tradition is the investiture ceremony, which personally reminds me of simultaneously of a wedding and a graduation ceremony. And I'd urge any architect to attend one. They are inspiring. Also, the college has its collection of hardware, medals, ribbons, pins, but each one has a unique story and a unique meaning.
So describe your experience going through that process, and then how does it feel to be a part of that 3%?
Well, like I said before, there's some people that will go for the ring, but most won't, ironically, besides their abilities and their achievements. That's always been a mystery to me. A fellowship pursuit is not for the faint of heart. It will take about 200 to 250 hours to prepare a submittal. It's also deeply personal, so you can't just pull in your marketing person and here, go do this. Maybe the graphics, but not the story. The story is yours. You will need a great sponsor, someone who knows you well, will wrap their arm around your shoulder and also kick you in the backside when you need it. I was fortunate to have my friend, Dr. Ray Pentecost, FAIA, FACHA, as my sponsor. Looking up to the top 3% means something different than being in the 3%. The former is aspirational. The latter carries significant responsibility to help others achieve their best. That platform is not the end. And I'm fortunate to know my sponsor's sponsor, Dr. Kirk Hamilton, FAIA, FACHA, who reminded me to continue developing the breadth of my own shoulders so that others can stand atop them.
If I recall correctly, I first met you, along with Lourdes Solara, FAIA as well, at one of the demystifying fellowship sessions at our annual convention. Briefly share the message of these sessions.
Well, for most AIA members, fellowship is a mystery. Who are they? What do they do? What does it matter? How do I become one? So the National College of Fellows regularly updates its program to demystify this process. And typically the AIA Florida representatives to the College of Fellows will conduct this session at the AIA Florida Convention and Trade Show. Lourdes and I were the College of Fellows representatives for a few years together. And we made a pretty effective team focusing on the value of and celebrating professional achievements like fellowship. Interestingly, we discovered that we're only 3 days apart in age. This year, Nathan Butler, FAIA, and Martin Diaz-Yabor, FAIA, are also the representatives from Florida. So briefly, this session covers the why and the what of fellowship, which I've discussed, and it also gets into the details of, well, how do you do it? To select a sponsor, organize your box of professional artifacts, telling your story, the jury process, etc. So in fact, Lourdes was recently serving on the jury of fellows.
So if someone was interested, would they reach out to Nathan and Martin?
They should. Nathan and Martin have access to all the fellows across the state, and there are more than 100 of them, believe it or not, and they're all willing to help.
As part of the executive committee of the College of Fellows, you are the 2025 bursar. What is the role of the bursar, and what are your goals as you serve in this role?
Well, the executive committee is comprised of essentially four roles: the chancellor, the vice chancellor, the secretary, and the bursar. Bursar is an old English term for a keeper of the purse. Both the secretary and bursar serve 2-year staggered terms and ultimately matriculate into the vice and then chancellor roles, each of which are single year roles. By that path, I think I'm going to be chancellor in 2028. The purpose of the executive committee is to manage the affairs of the college and its fund. As bursar, I'll be the closest to the management, which means I'll be working with our AIA staff liaison and outside fund counsel within the fund guidelines set by the XCOM. Our intent is to maintain continuous growth so that we can support several critical initiatives, such as the AIA component grants, the Latrobe Prize, and the college has recently joined the AIA National in supporting the Upjohn Research Initiative. The fund is supported by contributions from fellows and investment returns, and substantial donors can be recognized for annual or lifetime contributions.
I was not aware that becoming bursar was somewhat of a president-elect position and that you would get to serve as chancellor. So congratulations again.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I haven't done anything yet.
Well, we're all excited for you and looking forward to watching your career as you move through the College of Fellows, the executive board. But Bill, you're a prolific author, and I'd like you to share from the recent article why research is an architect's superpower.
Well, I never expected that my career would have me writing and presenting so much. So far, I've not discovered that there's a lot of money in it. I promised my wife that I'd really concentrate on revenue-producing projects more. However, it does allow some interesting ideas to develop and be published. So in late 2024, I wrote about the superpower nature of research being a game changer for architects and the powerful effects accruing to their clients. To most architects, this superpower has yet to be awakened. However, it has the power, I believe, to replenish architecture's professional authority when it's properly employed. Nobody else can make these claims and back them up unless they've been professionally trained and have the experience to do that. And that's what architects are. We have to claim that. So the value creation component of the 2024 well-being resolution, which was supported by the US General Services Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Blue Zones, the Construction Owners Association of America, several universities, and other allied organizations all wrote letters in staunch support of this initiative. And subsequently, the significance of this action was cited in both articles that appeared in the US and the UK.
I was there when you presented. It was at the convention, and it was quite powerful, your speech and then the support around the room. There was electricity around the room when you presented it.
Well, thank you for sharing that. You had a different perspective than I did. I was sweating bullets. I was waving a bunch of letters of support, thinking, okay, we've got this. And I actually made a bunch of friends, at the General Services Administration, the CDC, and they're all solidly for this. AIA Florida wrote a strong letter of support for this as well. The fact that it was ratified by an overwhelming supermajority, not just barely eking over the line, said, okay, there is something here that we really need to dig into. And this isn't just about, oh, no, we've got to do more stuff. No, this is about creating value for our profession.
Exactly, and there's no downside to it. And the unique thought is that, yes, right now it seems it pertains to healthcare facilities and assisted living and those types of spaces, but you can also take those philosophies and best practices, as you may or may not want to call them, but you can integrate them into office buildings where people spend the majority of their lives, or residences, again, where people spend their time. So I think they're cross building types. So again, I don't see where there's any downside to it. So it just serves to elevate the profession even more.
Well, this research began in the healthcare space because that's sort of how some healthcare architects are wired. And again, it's got its analog in medicine. Okay, it began there. But you're right. It's got application in how we design schools. And some school architecture are have been employing this these ideas and this research for a while. It relates to how we deal with justice facilities. It re how we do long-term care, how we do multifamily housing, how we do stadia or museums. Every project type has a benefit associated with this. Even retail, what are the psychological elements associated with better buying habits or keeping people in a store longer so they spend more money? And all of these things are have their roots in behavioral research, health environments research, et cetera. So I think this is the opportunity for architects to step up and say, okay, Mr. Retail Developer, you want to increase your sales? This is how we're going to do it. I don't know. I can't cite that research because I'm not in that space. But you understand the
Oh
essence.
yeah,
So
absolutely.
I think that there's some significant benefit associated with it.
What do you see as the greatest challenge facing the profession of architecture, both now and in the near future?
Well, I've discussed the value creation with initiatives like well-being. External voices of client organizations see this power, and now we're trying to get to the profession to catch up. As much as architects bemoan their clients' resistance to change, architects are sort of well, reluctant too. This also manifests itself in the work that our friend Jeff Huber, FAIA, and his strategic council did last year concerning the artificial intelligence and machine learning over the past couple of years. The adoption curve of this newer research will take time. But I'm concerned about the encroachment of other professions into our space if architects hesitate. We've got to claim this, and now is our time to do so. However, I think the greatest threat to our profession, and frankly, most other professions, is complacency and racing to the bottom. For my entire career, I've seen and heard architects complain about commoditization. I think that this is self-inflicted and based in fear rather than the confidence to add real value to clients. Clients may not need all the services or even all parts of the traditional services. Architects should be the ones making those assessments, and rather than bemoaning low fees for work of questionable value. Additionally, architects continuously underbid each other for similar scope, which only suppresses the market. It never helps us collectively as a profession. More sophisticated institutional clients recognize the value and have to deal with the low fee, low service results. But the lack of sophistication on the part of our profession allows us to be manipulated by market forces rather than driving them.
Talking about behavioral factors, and then your behavior is a result of your thinking. It would be so interesting to look at how we could change that thought process so that people learn that race to the bottom actually devalues everything you do, and then the perception, the public perception of what we do. So it would be really interesting
I
to hear.
agree with you. I agree with you. Architects in Europe, for example, have a much greater stature. I don't know that they make a lot more money, but their professional stature and their professional authority is very, very clear, as opposed to in the States where, you mean we have to hire an architect? Why do we have to do that? How much is that going to cost us? Are you serious? Can we get around that? Well, no, and not as much as you think it's going to cost on the backside when problems happen.
So, Bill, you've a soul for service and have an exemplary career in serving the profession and AIA. Tell us why you think membership in AIA is important.
My wife and I were married 40 years ago this year. So from the beginning, we decided, we were youngsters. We were very idealistic. Let's just define ourselves through our service in various professional organizations, church, various foundations, et cetera. We even drafted all of our five kids into these organizations. And the reason that we do this is because we can meet people where they are and share a common bond for a greater purpose, like raising money for pediatric care or expanding God's grace or even pouring into next generations. The AIA is not the only organization that represents professional architects, but it is the largest and most enduring. The AIA is a platform for professional matters to be advanced, especially through legislative action. Many states' practice acts are on the chopping block annually. So the AIA's advocacy teams stand in that gap convincingly with legislators. The AIA's national advocacy team has a regular agenda and has partners with other national organizations to get federal legislation accomplished. The AIA convenes and tracks continued competence beyond initial licensure through its continuing education programs at national, state, and local levels. The AIA clarifies what design excellence is through its framework for design excellence, a tool used by all national and some state and even some professional community specific award programs. And while these benefits and more are well worth annual dues, personal involvement allows one to really shape the future of the profession with other passionate architects. And that collegiality is its greatest benefit.
I absolutely agree with you. And I've been asked several times about my year as president. And I tell them the best part is meeting the people and creating relationships and knowing that you have this whole base of knowledge around this or around the state or around the country that you can call upon. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. Thank you, Bill, for your dedication and service to the profession, to AIA Florida, and for sharing with us today. I know I speak for all of AIA Florida when I tell you how much you're appreciated and how proud we are to have you represent us and the College of Fellows. I hope our listeners have enjoyed the conversation with Bill Hercules, FAIA, the 2025 College of Fellows Bursar. Bill is one of the many outstanding leaders from the state of Florida representing the profession. For more information on the College of Fellows, you can use the links in the podcast notes. Thank you for listening to the Voice of Florida Architecture, the podcast for AIA Florida. You can find us wherever you stream your podcast. I'm your host, Rhonda Hammond, AIA.